This is lecture number 8 on the Prophecies of Daniel by Alan McRae. Again, lecture is number 8. Maybe I better mention a question that was turned into me that I think is very important, so I wanted to read it to you. It's called A Practical Question, and here it is. Quote, Daniel chapter 7 verse 10, it says, the judgment was set, or the court sat. What do you suggest we do while preaching this passage? Is it possible to bring out an interpretation such as yours without bewildering and distracting the audience? Do we simply mention the problem and our opinions? Or do we add remarks about the difficulties of translation and so on? It's been my experience that people have been very touchy about any change in what their version of the Bible says. Here a difference in meaning seems to be involved. End quote. That is the question. Now this, I think, is really a very important question because the spokesman for God has two very important duties. One is to be sure of what God says, and the second is to say it in such a way that he or she will be able to get the truth across. Now a person can be sure that God has said, quote, whosoever believes in the Lord Jesus Christ will be saved, end quote. He can be sure that there is only one God. He can be sure that there are three persons in the Godhead that we call the Trinity. There are many things of which we can be absolutely sure. And the vital task of the Christian interpreter is to get these things across, which are absolutely clear in the Scripture. God sometimes uses people with practically no education who read a few simple truths and present them. And it's far better to present a few simple truths and have people get them than what it is to give a great deal of truth in such a way that nobody gets any of it. This is a very, very vital part of the work of every one of us, and we do not want to confuse people, which will happen if a person says something like, quote, well, some say this and some say that, end quote. Or, quote, the Hebrew word is this, that, and the other thing, and this commentator says one thing and the other commentator says something else, but I looked in the dictionary and here's what I found, end quote. I remember hearing a minister who had one of his congregation bring him a big sack of potatoes, and he said, and I think I'm quoting him verbatim here, well, I surely appreciate it, but why did you bring me these potatoes? End quote. And the person who brought them said, quote, and I'm going from memory again, I so often heard you say that the potatoes disagree with you. End quote. You say potatoes? Well, he meant common taters. Common taters, potatoes. You get it, I hope. Well, I think that she had no idea what the minister was talking about, and there is no point in that. We have to have some idea of the people to whom we talk and how much they understand, and we should shape our messages accordingly. But the main thing is to help them understand what God says in the Scripture. At the same time, God gave His Word not simply to deal with a few simple truths, or He would have given us two or three chapters instead of the whole Bible. His Word gives us a great deal that is absolutely clear, and a great deal that has tremendous relevance at one time but is difficult to understand at another time. There may be parts of the Bible that we have a great deal of difficulty in understanding today that have just exactly the truth that God's people will need, say, 10 years from now, if the Lord tarries. New problems are arising all the time, and the answer to the problems is in the Bible. And so we are trying to train people whom we hope will be able to give the great central truths of the Bible in such a way that we'll get these truths across to people. But we here have a greater objective than that. We here in this class, we here in this seminary, we want to train those who can go to the Word of God and see exactly what it means and what its truth is and relate it to situations as they change. So there are two duties of our graduates and people of the caliber we hope our graduates will be. There are two different duties. One is learning what the Bible means, and the second is presenting it to people in the way that they understand the great truths of the Bible. I believe that we should keep these two as sharply separated in our minds. So that I feel that it is vital that when you can't be sure of what a passage means, you don't just jump to a conclusion or make it up what you think it means. But you should see what the possibilities are, and then as you study some other passage or as situations change, you may then see exactly what the passage did mean and how it fits in with the insight you've gained from some other passage or from some other changing situation in the world. So I believe it is tremendously important that you study the Bible very carefully, that we have a certain number of people who are able to go out and say, quote, this verse is absolutely clear, end quote, or this other verse has two possibilities, and we're not at present in a position to decide between them. This verse has two possibilities. One of them I feel almost sure is correct, but I'm not going to bank on that except as I find supporting evidence from other passages. A very important part of your work is going to be to study, or in understanding, the Word. A very important part of your work is your study or understanding of the Word, and a very important part is also giving the people the truth you know they need without confusing them. There is also really a second element in this question, and let me quote that part again. Some people have been very touchy about any change in what their version says, end quote. And by that we mean their version of the Bible. As someone said jokingly, if the King James Version was good enough for St. Paul, why isn't it good enough for us? Well, we all know that that was not the case, that the King James Version was developed in 1611, almost 1500 years after St. Paul wrote his letters. Yet I got a printed piece of literature the other day from a very active Christian worker who actually said in it, and I'm quoting here, are we to believe that God left us 1900 years without knowing what the true Bible is? End quote. Which certainly implies that the King James Version of the Bible is what St. Paul had. We know that the King James Version was a translation made by godly men. They were excellent scholars. They were aware of the situations of their day, but they were using a language that today very few people understand, let alone speak. There are many words in the King James Version of the Bible that very few people today understand because some of them are not used at all and some of them have changed their meaning. Most of it we can figure out fairly well what it means, and there are places where the translators certainly erred in their translation. Though on this ground, I find many cases where I think the King James translators, as far as meaning is concerned, really did a better job than many recent interpreters have done. But none of us talk the way they did, and consequently, we can be sure that we don't exactly get it in many places in the Bible when we read the King James. And in that situation, it is absolutely necessary that the people of today have a Bible in their own language that they can understand today. And naturally, as in the days of the King James, there were a dozen different versions competing for attention, and so there will be versions competing for attention today. So I don't believe many intelligent Christians are going to stay long in the situation where they use only one particular English version of the Bible and think that that is the only right version, especially if it is in a language that they don't understand. I think that's a problem that won't stay with us very long. People will recognize that getting an exact translation is impossible. And yet, we have a very good approximation to the original in a number of translations. I think the New International Version that's just come out is, as far as I can see, the best translation that has yet been made. It ought to be the present best modern translation, given the tremendous number of hours and thousands of hours, I might say, that were spent by literally hundreds of translators in working on the New International Version. In fact, the New International Version, or the NIV, is to be presented tomorrow to people in Philadelphia. They're hoping to have two or three pastors with them and have a press release, and I've been asked to go and participate in the presentation of the NIV. I think that I wish that the time would come again when we have one English version that we could all agree to use, but I doubt if that will happen in the coming years. But ordinarily, I don't think that in preaching you want to enter into problems of translation. I do believe that there will be times that, if you give the Word of God sincerely, you will have to say something like, this English or this Hebrew word or this Greek word cannot be translated exactly into English, but here's a good approximation, here's another attempt at trying to explain what these words mean. You'll have to do that. But in a matter like Daniel's vision, where there is such a difference of meaning as to whether this is a judgment scene or whether it is a presentation of God's omnipotent power as he carries out the judgments that he has already made, in a situation like that, I would say that ordinarily it would be wise to take the great truths in the passage that are very vital, in which there is no doubt, and stress them and only lightly touch on the differences of opinion. I would suggest that in ordinary groups, that is the wise thing to do. But there will, if you have intelligent audiences, be times when it is wise to enter into a problem like that and show the reasons on each side and see how it fits with other passages. That is so important, I thought it was worth taking a bit of time on that particular question. Now, as we move on, we remind ourselves that in our last lecture we spoke about how in chapter 7 we have the new kingdom as we looked at it and noticed the different factors there, and I believe we had finished our general discussion of what is given about the new kingdom in that chapter, and then we were ready to look at capital H in our outline, quote, conclusions regarding chapters 2 and 7, end quote. We have four kingdoms described in both chapters. Now, as a matter of methodology, when we had chapter 2, I said from this chapter you can't tell whether there are four kingdoms or five. You'll remember that discussion. I think that it is vital that we recognize this. We do not get from chapter 2 the assurance of whether there are four kingdoms or five kingdoms. There are definitely five parts of the statue, if you count the toes with the iron and the clay mixture as another part. We know that there are five parts to the statue, but are there four kingdoms or five kingdoms? You really can't tell whether it's four or five. But when you come to chapter 7, this question, I believe, is answered. And so, 45 years later, which is the time difference between chapter 2 and chapter 7 of Daniel, God revealed that there were four animals, not five. But there is a second phase to the fourth animal, which is represented by a fifth part of the statue in Daniel chapter 2. The four kingdoms there described can be seen in history. We who believe that Daniel wrote this book in the time of Nebuchadnezzar have no problem in fitting them with history. The Babylonian kingdom, the Medo-Persian empire, the Hellenistic empire, and the Roman empire. These are the four kingdoms. Those who hold the critical view, of course, say that it was not written until the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, and that it goes up to that period only, and they have a history of three kingdoms and predictions for a fourth, but they have to imagine a separate Median kingdom which did not exist. And so, as far as history is concerned, those who accept it as a genuine book of Daniel have no problem. Now, as to the relation of the second part of the fourth kingdom, it is quite evident that that second part has not yet occurred. The nearest to it would be 400 to 600 AD, which would come very near to fitting the second phase of the fourth kingdom, but which has a phrase in it that, quote, they were mingling with the seed of men, end quote, which is pretty hard to understand. It's hard to know what that phrase means. Personally, I think that what it means will become clear when that period comes. If you say, quote, well, that fits with the period AD 400 to 600, end quote. But it could fit with almost all history before that. It's not much of a distinctive feature to say that there will be a mingling with the seed of men. More important is that the stone that hits the statue in Daniel chapter 2 hits it on the feet and toes. But at the end of the Roman Empire, there was no establishment of a new kingdom. The stone, we see in Daniel chapter 2 again, completely destroys every visage of the four kingdoms. That is to say, it destroyed the qualities that enter into human government as shown in those four kingdoms. So it seems to me that this second part must be something that is still future, for we still have these qualities in human government around us. And there we have two possibilities. One is that there is an unmentioned interval between the first and second phase of the fourth kingdom. We have the first part of the fourth kingdom, then you have a long space that is not seen in the vision, and then you have the second part of this kingdom. The other possibility is that this is general. That is, that what you have here are four kingdoms as they would be seen looking forward from Daniel's time. The first three were each taken over by a succeeding one. The fourth one was not taken over, but had many different changes, as it was being overrun by new peoples, and gradual changes took place as new peoples were incorporated into the Roman Empire. As the prophet looked forward, he would see that extending far into the future, this would be the case. And there would be that final stage of it that is yet to come. Now, both views can be represented by the figure of mountains. I've used this figure before. As you see the near peaks, they look very large, and then beyond them, you see other peaks, and beyond the second range of peaks, still others. But there may be a valley between the ridges, or there may be a gray mountain in the distance, which you can't tell whether it comes directly behind the first ridge of mountains, or whether it really is pretty far away. So in between the two phases of the fourth kingdom, whether there is an unmentioned interval, which I liken to a valley in the mountain range analogy that I made, or a continuing ridge, we cannot be dogmatic between the two views at this point. One thing that was brought out in chapter 7, however, that is not at all brought out in chapter 2, is what is today spoken of as the Antichrist. Now, in a way, that is an unfortunate term. It might be better if we called it, quote, the little horn, end quote, for that is what is used by Daniel. But as far as the Antichrist goes, John said there are many Antichrists, but that the Antichrist is already here. The Reformers declared that the papacy was the Antichrist. There was much to suggest that in those days. Very much then, of course, since that time, the papacy has gone through all kinds of changes through the years, but at that time, when the papacy was so strong, opposing salvation by faith alone in such a strong, definite, and to a large extent, effective way, it was easy for the Reformers to reach that conclusion that the Pope equaled the Antichrist. We must say, as John said in his letter, there are many Antichrists. But there is one who is represented by the little horn, and it is customary today to call that one the Antichrist. I suppose we might as well stick to the term, but since the term can be applied to others, I wish we had another use for it. This one who is called the little horn, who fights against the saints and almost overcomes them, and is only the supernatural intervention of God that prevents him from overcoming them, this one is mentioned in Isaiah chapter 11, where we read in Isaiah chapter 11 about the coming of the Son of Man, and Isaiah says in chapter 11, verse 4, and I'm quoting here, "With the breath of his lips he shall slay the wicked," end quote. And this word, or this phrase, "the wicked," does not convey the idea of the original to people today. This is a very good illustration about how our language has changed. When I was in Germany, they would refer to me as, quote, "the large," end quote, because the German word "large" simply means tall. It doesn't refer at all to your girth. And they would refer to me as simply "the large" or "the tall." Now, in English, if you say "the tall," you mean a lot of tall people. We don't use it for one individual, although it is an adjective today. But in King James' time, they did. They do today in German. They did in Hebrew. They do it in Greek. In most languages that I know that have different forms for singular and plural adjectives, you can put the word the, T-H-E, before the adjective, and you get the word the tall, meaning the tall one. But let's look at this word wicked, which is singular in Hebrew. And I quote again from Isaiah chapter 11, verse 4. He will destroy the wicked one with the breath of his mouth, end quote. And this is paralleled in chapter 7 of Daniel when the Son of Man comes with the clouds of heaven, and as a result, the little horn that fought against the saints is destroyed. Paul referred back to Isaiah very clearly, I think, in 2 Thessalonians. In the second chapter, where he says in verse 2 and at the end of verse 3, and now I quote from 2 Thessalonians, that man of sin will be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is God, end quote. And it refers to him again in verse 8, and I quote again from 2 Thessalonians verse 8, then shall that wicked one be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the sword of his mouth and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming, end quote. Paul predicted this one whom Isaiah also predicted. He is certainly the one who is called the little horn in chapter 7 of Daniel. Now, if we do call him Antichrist, let's just keep in mind that this term is used for others. But here is one special one who perhaps we should call Antichrist with a capital A, or the Antichrist, who, as far as anyone knows, is yet to come. I remember back just at the end of World War I, I read a comment by a missionary from the Near East who said he had already seen the Antichrist. He said he was living there, but not yet revealed to the world. He said, and I quote here from his letter, I have seen him perform simple miracles, like simply looking at someone and they drop dead, and he's doing things like that. But, he said, of course, he'll do far greater miracles when he is revealed to the world. End quote. Well, many years have passed since that time, so I think that missionary was wrong as to who he thought the Antichrist was. The Antichrist may be living today, but if so, I doubt if anyone could identify him. He might not come for many years. The Lord said that we don't know when he is coming back. We're not to know. So for all we can say, it might be another century or more before the Antichrist comes. But it is made clear by Paul and by Isaiah and by Daniel that there is to be one who will be a great user of wicked power, who will make war with the saints, and he would win the war were it not for the intervention of the Son of Man. In chapter 2 of Daniel 7, we had the account of the stone that hit the statue and completely destroyed it, and then the stone grew until it became the great mountain that filled the whole earth. Here in chapter 7, we have the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven, then we have the beast destroyed, which includes the little horn, of course, destroyed and his body given to the fire. Not a visage of it remains. The Son of Man establishes a great new kingdom which cannot be destroyed. And as we noticed before, that of course does not mean that there will not be a change in organization after 1,000 years. God is certainly not going to establish a permanently fixed condition with no change whatsoever. There is an old idea that some Greek philosophers had who thought that God was like one great wooden Indian, perhaps that stands there absolutely immovable, unchangeable, past, present, and future are all the same to him. That's not a Christian idea. Certainly the Bible teaches that God feels sorrow, God feels joy, that God does things. We cannot make God into just some sort of fixed, immovable thing. Now, he is unchangeable in his qualities, unchangeable in his attributes, unchangeable in his love. But he grieves and he rejoices. He is a spirit and he has the qualities that our spirits have, and so what will happen beyond 1,000 years after the Lord comes back, we don't know a great deal about, but we know that there will be some change. It is in the nature of God, just as it is in the nature of ourselves. I was talking to someone once. I told him how I wished I could climb a certain mountain. I've climbed many mountains in my day, and there are many others that I would like to climb as well. But there just isn't enough time in life to do so. And so I said I used to feel very sad about not being able to climb all the mountains that I'd like to climb. But then I realized that during the millennium, I'll have time to climb a lot of those. And the man said to me, "Well," he said, "you say the millennium. Why don't you say the eternal state?" I don't think there is any such thing in the Bible as an eternal state. What will happen beyond the millennium, we just don't know. God may have many interesting surprises for us, but all the sin and wickedness of this life is to be eradicated at the coming of the Son of Man. And we can all say amen to that. So now we're ready to take a jump forward, which may seem strange to jump clear forward from chapter 7 to chapter 11 of Daniel. But the reason I wish to do that is that there are certain things that will come out in chapter 7 which are much easier to discuss in connection with chapter 11 than with chapter 8, and it will make it much easier for us to deal with chapter 8 if we look at these two chapters, 7 and 11, first. Now, I think it would be a mistake to look at chapter 7 first and then look at chapter 2, because chapter 2 was given 45 years before chapter 7. And so we can use chapter 7 to throw light back on chapter 2, but we should start with chapter 2. But here we have chapter 7, which was given in the first year of Belshazzar. And we have chapter 8, which was given in the third year of Belshazzar. And then chapter 9 was given in the first year of Darius, whom Cyrus made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, over that portion of the empire. And then we have chapter 10 to chapter 12, which were in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. And so these chapters are given in a very short range of time. So there's no great harm done in our looking at chapter 11 first before chapter 7, or chapter 11 in connection with chapter 7, and doing that before chapter 8, because here we're dealing with a very short time, unlike 45 years that separate chapters 2 and 7. Now, chapter 11 is a chapter that not many people get a great deal out of, I fear. The archbishop who put in the chapter division certainly didn't understand it, because, as you know, he put the chapter division one verse too early, in my opinion at least. Chapter 10 tells about God sending a messenger to Daniel, and this messenger speaks, and in chapter 11, verse 1, he is telling about his previous difficulties in bringing this message to Daniel. But verse 2 begins the prophecy, and here I read chapter 11, verse 2, and I quote, "Now will I show you the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings of Persia, and the fourth shall be richer than all of them." End quote. We know what the critics say, that according to the book of Daniel, there were only four kings of Persia. There were only these four, and the author didn't know about any other. He was just ignorant. I have given you a statement, which I hope you all have with you, which records important facts about the history of this time period, and it lists all the kings of Persia except one. And that one was a usurper who held power for a very brief time. I haven't listed all the kings. I have listed the ones vital to us, and then listed six more kings, and then named the last one. There were actually 10 kings of Persia in the period of the Persian Empire, between its establishment by Cyrus and its conquest by Alexander the Great. Here the angel says that there will be three kings, and the fourth will be richer than they all, and in verse 3 he says, and I quote, "A mighty king shall stand up," end quote, who we find out is the king who destroys the Persian Empire. The fact of the matter is, of course, that the chapter here is giving us certain vital points and not telling us a complete history of what is happening in between. And so we have here, in order to pinpoint a particular point, we have mentioned just the first four kings. Now, the first of these is Cyrus. And I have the dates, 559 BC, there he became king, And in 546, he gained his independence and took over control of the whole Median complex of tribes. In 539 BC, Cyrus conquered Babylon, and in 529 he died. Then he was succeeded by his son Cambyses, who reigned from 529 to 522 BC. I did not list here a king called Pseudo-Smerdis, which was a name given to a usurper who held power for just 8 months, but he certainly could be ranked as a king of Persia. So we have these three, Cyrus and Cambyses and Smerdis, or Pseudo-Smerdis. Cyrus is the first, and then after Cyrus there is Cambyses, then Pseudo-Smerdis, but we don't really count him for reasons that we'll mention, and then Darius, and the fourth then would be Xerxes. Now, I mention we don't include Pseudo-Smerdis because he didn't amount to much, and I doubt that he is one of the four kings that Daniel had in mind. But I need to call your attention a little bit more to the history at this point. Cyrus, as you know, began in Persia with a small domain. He got control of all the realm of the Medes, and then he went westward and conquered all of Asia Minor, which today is modern Turkey. He conquered all of Asia Minor, and then he turned back south and conquered the Babylonian Empire. Then he went east again, and conquered as far as you can see here on the map, clear into the area that we call India. Between him and his son, they conquered all of Afghanistan. Then either he or his son conquered northwest India. His son Cambyses even went down and conquered all of Egypt. So that was the largest empire the world had ever seen up to that time. But after Cyrus's death, and after Cambyses' death, this Pseudo-Smerdis reigned for 8 months, but then a cousin of Cambyses, named Darius, got rid of Pseudo-Smerdis and proclaimed himself the legitimate king. In reality, Darius might be called a second founder of the Persian Empire. Darius organized the empire, bringing all these regions under his control. Darius did have rebellions over all the empire, especially the first few years of his reign, but they were occupied putting down these rebellions, and he succeeded in getting the whole empire under his control. But then he organized the empire in such a way that it continued in great strength for about 200 years and was probably just about as strong at the end as it was at the beginning. But Alexander the Great was such a great strategist, he was a great fighter, and he had a wonderful army, so he was able to conquer Persia in a comparatively short space of about 12 years. But Darius thus raised the empire to the highest point at which it had yet been. Our text says that the fourth king shall be far richer than them all. The fourth inherited greater wealth and greater power than either of the previous kings had, except Darius at the end of his reign. Who is this fourth king? This fourth king is Xerxes. It also says that the fourth king will be richer than all of them, and that by his strength and his riches, he is going to stir up the realm against Greece. Many of you who have studied ancient history, as it used to be at least, they didn't pay a great deal of attention to Oriental background, but most people who have gone through school have paid a little attention to the history of Greece. Well, anyone who reads much about ancient Greece is familiar with the Persian Wars. The Greeks had settled cities, and they had built cities and colonies along the shores of Asia Minor as well as in Greece. And these were very great, prosperous Greek cities. But they were all conquered by Cyrus and became part of the Persian Empire. But the Greeks didn't want to be part of the Persian Empire. They constantly tried to gain their freedom. Now Cyrus could hold them in subjection fairly easily with his great army, and Darius could hold them in subjection fairly easily with his great army and his wonderful organization, were it not for the fact that the cities of Greece were constantly sending help to these cities in Asia Minor. They were trying to help their fellow Greeks gain independence in their cities on the coast of Asia Minor. And so Darius said, quote, "I'll put a stop to this. I'll conquer Greece too," end quote. Well, I'm making it up. I don't know if he said that exactly, but you get the idea. And he sent a great army to attack Greece and to try to conquer Greece, but due to bad weather and partly due to mistakes in strategy by his generals, Darius failed. And the Greeks were very proud of having fought back Darius's attempt to conquer them. But Darius said, "We must conquer Greece. We can't have them constantly raising rebellions against us in Asia Minor." And so Darius set to work to gather the greatest army the world had ever seen. And 10 years were devoted to gathering this great army and to preparing tremendous amounts of material. But before it was all ready, Darius died. And so, the fourth king, who was far richer than them all, Xerxes, when this great army was ready, he started out to conquer Greece. And they say it took a whole week for his army to walk across the bridge that he had built across the Hellespont near Constantinople, or Istanbul today, that connects Asia and Europe. It was a tremendous army and a tremendous navy, and the Greeks facing this would ordinarily have had little hope of defeating it. But as it worked out, there was a combination of circumstances and the fact that this army contained people with so many different languages, it was difficult for them to communicate and to direct the battle as they should. Some bad storms also injured many of the Persian ships, and the Greeks were able to maneuver other Persian ships into a place where they were at a great disadvantage. Though we haven't time to go into the details of it, it is a very remarkable thing in the history that the Greeks succeeded in defeating this tremendous attempt to destroy them. And the Greeks after that time were constantly remembering the great glory of their victory over the Persians and looking forward to the time when they would be completely able to end Persian control of the Greek cities that were in Asia Minor. Now, going back to Daniel, we read this statement, quote, "By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece," end quote. And this is a very precise prediction of something that took place a few decades after Daniel wrote, if we believe, as we do, that Daniel really wrote this. Now, according to the critics, this is someone looking back and giving a correct statement of history, not of prophecy. Xerxes, yes, is the fourth king. Yes, he is the one who by his strength, through his riches, stirs up all against the realm of Greece. Then verse 3 says, and I quote here, "A mighty king will stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will," end quote. Now that doesn't tell us much about what this man is going to do. It points to his great strength and power. But then you read in chapter 11, verse 4, you have very specific details about Alexander the Great. And so there is absolutely no doubt that Alexander the Great is the one referred to in verses 3 and 4 of Daniel chapter 11. And Alexander the Great fulfilled the great desire of the Greeks to get back at the Persians on account of the Persian attempt to destroy Greece. But there is an interval of well over a century. Xerxes became king in 486 BC, I forget the exact date, but it was about 480 BC when he attempted to conquer Greece. It was 336 BC when Alexander the Great became king. So you have about 150 years passing over between verse 2 and verse 3 of Daniel chapter 11. This is an unmentioned interval, 150 years, at this point, as you see. There's no question that verse 2 refers to Xerxes, and there's no question that verse 3 refers to Alexander. An unmentioned interval of 150 years is between. And this brings out what I've mentioned with my mountain analogies. We have one range of mountains, we could call that Xerxes. We have another range of mountains, call that Alexander the Great. They appear to be together when you just look at the prophecy in Daniel chapter 11, but we realize that there is a 150-year valley, if I may use the term, between these two mountain peaks. You wouldn't know much about Alexander from verse 3. It doesn't tell about his conquering the Persian Empire, but that is perhaps implied. We know that's what happened historically, and that is specifically stated in chapter 8 that we'll get to later. But in verse 4 of chapter 11 of Daniel, we read, quote, "When he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided towards the four winds of heaven," end quote. Alexander the Great, after 12 years of constant fighting in which he performed the greatest blitzkrieg perhaps the world has ever seen, or at least when you think of the relation of the materials he had to the materials available this century, in that view, you can certainly say it was the greatest blitzkrieg the world had ever seen. Alexander originated from Macedonia in the north of Greece proper. He got Greece under his control, then he moved eastward and conquered areas that never had been subject to his father Philip in Macedon. He crossed into Asia Minor. There he met a great Persian army and defeated it, and then he marched down into Syria. He found that he couldn't go farther into the Persian Empire without destroying the Persian navy because he had to secure his lines of supplies. So he spent a couple of years in gaining control of the coastal cities there. He spent 9 months just conquering Tyre. Then he went south into Egypt. Egypt had been conquered by Cambyses the Persian and had been subject to the Persians for 100 years, and then had gained its freedom. 90 years later, Egypt revolted against the Persians after their conquest, and it gained freedom after about a century. But then, after it had been free for about 90 years, the Persians again attacked Egypt and reconquered it, and they had held it only 10 years when Alexander came. So after Alexander came, the people in Egypt welcomed him as further protection against the Persians, whom they disliked. Alexander claimed to be their deliverer against the Persians, and Alexander worshipped the Egyptian gods and declared himself to be a successor of the old pharaoh. But all this took time. Then Alexander marched inland, met another great Persian army, and destroyed it. He conquered all of Persia, and he marched clear east as far as India. Then he returned to Babylon, and suddenly there he was taken ill, and after about 10 days with a bad fever, he died. Some people suggest he contracted malaria. And here was a young man in his early 30s who had done this tremendous feat who suddenly died. And it says, interestingly enough, here in Daniel, quote, "His kingdom shall be broken and divided towards the four winds of heaven and not to his posterity," end quote. When Alexander died, the question was, who shall succeed him? Well, he had an idiot half-brother who everybody knew did not have the ability to reign. But you might say he would have a claim to be the ruler. I think he was older than Alexander, but I'm not sure. But the only way he could rule would be as a figurehead. And Alexander also had married a Persian woman, and they were expecting, and she would have a child, and the child, of course, would then have claims to be a ruler if he were a male. And that child should be the true successor, many thought. And so there was a division of opinion about who should rule, but in either case, they had to have a king in the empire. So the idea was that the idiot half-brother would become king, and he would reign as king until the boy would come of age that Alexander had with his Persian wife. And so they appointed a regent, and they divided up all the vast empire into 20 parts, and the different generals agreed to control these 20 parts and to rule them. And so the empire was divided towards, quote, the four winds of heaven, end quote, as our text says. But soon many of these generals decided they wanted to be emperor. And so Alexander's child was destroyed, his half-brother was destroyed, his mother was killed, and every single relative of his in the course of the next 15 years was murdered. So none of his posterity succeeded as ruler, anyone that is, who was related to Alexander. Nor, when looking at his dominion which he ruled, not one of his commanders, though they fought for nearly 40 years trying to get control of the whole empire, not one of them succeeded in gaining control. So their dominion was much inferior to that which Alexander had held. And I quote again from Daniel, quote, for his kingdom shall be plucked up and given to others, end quote. Now you have that picture of the kingdom which Alexander held. It is divided up, and then the next verse begins with the words, quote, the king of the south shall be strong, end quote. And what do you think would be meant by the king of the south? It would seem quite obvious that Egypt is in view. It is much farther south than any other part of the empire. And one of Alexander's generals, called Ptolemy, was more far-seeing than the rest. He saw that this empire would not be kept together. It would be impossible, and he said, I would like to be governor of Egypt. And they all said, well, that's fine with us. If you would like to be governor of Egypt, fine. You can have Egypt, and we'll take this other section, or that other section. And so they divided up Alexander's empire, with Ptolemy figuring if he had Egypt, he would not be attacked except by the small area coming in from the north, from Asia, which today we call the Levant, that includes Lebanon, Syria, and Israel, or he would be attacked from the sea. And if he kept a strong navy, he could continue ruling his kingdom safely, regardless of what happened to the rest of the empire. And with that as a secure base, he might be able to get all of the rest of the empire as well. And so when we read, quote, the king of the south shall be strong, end quote, it was literally fulfilled in Ptolemy. And then it says, quote, and one of his princes, he shall be strong above him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion, end quote. Now, as Ptolemy fought with other generals, the man who had been governor of the area of Babylon was driven out from that area, and he went to Egypt and became one of Ptolemy's leading officers. This person who ruled in Babylon's name was Seleucus. And Seleucus became one of Ptolemy's leading officers, so he could be properly called one of his princes. But Seleucus, with Ptolemy's help, went back up into Asia, and in 312 BC, he established himself in control of Babylon and eventually got control of the whole empire from there north through most of Asia Minor and even eastward clear into India. So Seleucus had perhaps half of the area of Alexander's empire. And so when Daniel says, quote, he shall be strong above him, end quote, we mean that Seleucus was stronger than Ptolemy. He had been one of his officials and had dominion, and his dominion shall be a great dominion, and so it was. So up to this point, if you look forward, you couldn't have told what would happen, but if you look back at the time and you look at the history, you see how easily Daniel had been able to predict the course of these important events. It was not given to satisfy curiosity about the future. His visions were given in order that those living at that time would see all this happening, what Daniel had said, and that would prove that Daniel was a true prophet. It would prove that his words were dependable and would focus our minds on those matters to which he would give more attention later on. Unfortunately, we don't have time to do that now. We will pick up later prophecies next time. Thus ends lecture number 8 of Alan McCrae, The Prophecies of Daniel.